Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe, discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. And before we get started with today's episode, I want to just let you guys know of a couple things. So first of all, this episode is going to be in a video format. So if you'd like to watch it on YouTube, it'll be on YouTube. And Spotify is also implementing some new video format content as well. So I'm trying to get connected with that. And then if you're on Patreon, you can also view the video form of this episode. I think it's helpful to be able to see the pictures in real time as you listen to this or any episode to kind of know what people look like, know what the scene looks like. I just think it kind of helps tell the whole story. So that is something new that we are, or that I am, implementing. Also, my book, Wicked Women, came out on Saturday, and it was so surreal. We had a book signing event in our hometown in St. Joseph, Missouri, and it was so great. The people that showed up, I was just so thankful that people even showed up at all. But the reaction or the response I've gotten from releasing this book has been so supportive, and I'm so grateful. And I have to say this because I know it sounds cliche to say, oh, I wouldn't be where I'm at without you guys. I truly do firmly believe that. And if it weren't for our community supporting not just me, but Austin too, in all of our endeavors, we would not be where we are. So when I say that I'm very thankful for the people who listen or show up or engage and comment and download all the things, I truly do mean that. I am so grateful. So this episode is actually dedicated to one of our longtime listeners and big time supporters. Her name is Wendy. And Wendy is that type of friend who just shows up to support
anyone and everyone. Like, she makes it work. She even had a birthday party the same day as the book release, but she made a point to show up and at least say hi and then recommended this case to me. And so this one is going to be for her. I feel like everyone needs a Wendy in their life, someone who just endlessly supports, shows up to all the things and makes it happen. And she's like that, not just with me, but with other people I see as well. She's just always there to empower women. So, you know, that testament of empowered women, empower women. I feel like Wendy really encapsulates that. So this episode, Wendy, is for you. And I'm sure you can probably guess today we are talking about the Villisca, Iowa axe murders. So without further ado, let's dive into this wild story. Villisca, Iowa in 1912 was a close-knit Midwestern town of about 2,500 residents. Despite its small size, Villisca was really bustling. Trains passed through daily. Remember, this is 1912 at the time. Businesses lined the main street, and the community even boasted the first publicly funded armory in Iowa. Now, this was the kind of place where everyone knew everyone. Everyone kind of left their doors unlocked. It was just a small, tight-knit community. In this peaceful town, the Moore family was among the most well-regarded residents. Josiah, or Joe Moore, was 43 years old and a successful businessman. He ran a farm equipment dealership and had secured a coveted John Deere franchise. Years earlier, Josiah had worked for a prominent Villisca businessman and state senator named Frank Jones, but he left to open his own store, reportedly taking a big client with him. Josiah's departure caused a local stir. I'm sure you can imagine people kind of talking about that. But in 1912, the Moore family was really thriving. Josiah's wife, 39-year-old Sarah, whose maiden name was Montgomery, was active in the Presbyterian Church, and she was the proud mother of their four children, Herman, Mary Catherine, Arthur, and Paul. They were known to be an affluent and well-liked family, deeply woven into the fabric of Villisca's community life. That summer, the Moore children were excited for Sunday, June 9th of 1912. It was the church's annual Children's Day program. Sarah had helped organize the evening's festivities, and all the kids, along with many from town, participated. Among the attendees were two sisters, 12-year-old Lena Stillinger and 8-year-old Ina Stillinger. They lived in a farm outside of Villisca and were friends with the Moore kids. The Moore kids begged their parents for a sleepover with Lena and Ina. And that night, Josiah called the Stillinger girls' older sister to ask for permission. Now, with the okay given, the two girls joined the Moore family for the night. After the church program ended around 9:30 p.m., the Moores and the Stillinger sisters walked back to the Moore house, arriving sometime between 9:45 and 10 p.m. It was a quiet, pleasant evening as they settled in for bed, unaware of what was about to happen. Before we move on, let's introduce a few other people who are tied to this story. The Moore's next door neighbor was Mary Peckham, a 63-year-old widow who would soon be the first to sense that something was wrong at the Moore house. Josiah's brother, Ross Moore, also lived nearby and was really close with the family. Villisca's marshal, the primary lawman in town, was Hank Horton, and the Montgomery County sheriff was Orrin Jackson. They would end up leading the initial investigation, and as mentioned earlier, State Senator Frank F. Jones was a powerful Villisca resident and former employer to Josiah Moore, a connection that will become important when we discuss the suspects in this case. With all of that out of the way, let's dive into the fateful night of June 9th, 1912. Sunday night faded into the early hours of Monday, June 10th of 1912, and all eight people in the Moore house, two adults and six children, were fast asleep by midnight. What they didn't know was that someone else may have already been hiding in their home, lying in wait. Much later, investigators would find two spent cigarettes in the attic, suggesting that an intruder quietly camped out up there as the family went to bed, which is just so creepy and scary to think about. Whether the killer snuck in while the Moores were at church or slipped inside afterward through an unlocked door or window, we don't know. We can just only imagine this creepy person up in the attic chain-smoking cigarettes. Now, sometime after midnight, the killer made his move, gripping a heavy axe, one that actually belonged to Joe Moore, and the intruder first crept into the master bedroom where Josiah and Sarah were sleeping. In the darkness, the assailant raised the axe and brought it down on 43-year-old Josiah's head with devastating force. In fact, Josiah would receive more blows than any other victim. His face was struck so viciously that his eyes were completely destroyed. The ceiling above the bed even bore these huge gouge marks from the upswing of the axe. Sarah woke for only an instant, if at all, before the axe fell on her as well. Notably, the murderer appeared to use the sharp blade of the axe on Sarah while bludgeoning the rest of the victims with the blunt, flat side of the axe. In those few frenzied moments, both parents were brutally killed. The killer then moved from the small house to the children's room adjacent to the master bedroom. One by one, 11-year-old Herman, 10-year-old Mary Catherine, 7-year-old Arthur, and 5-year-old Paul were bludgeoned to death in their beds. It appears none of the children had time to fully awake or even cry out. The attacks were quick, and hopefully they didn't know what was happening. After he killed the 4 more children, the assailant was not done. He went back to the master bedroom and, in an act of complete overkill, which makes me think that this was a deeply personal attack, he went and struck Josiah and Sarah's lifeless bodies again and again. Investigators later found a shoe next to the bed that had been filled with blood, then overturned, a sign that the killer returned to deliver those additional blows after the blood had already pooled. So it was as if the murderer's rage was especially directed at the Moores, Joe in particular, hacking him far beyond what was needed to kill him. Now, finally, the intruder descended the narrow stairway into the first floor guest bedroom where young Lena and Ina Stillinger were still sleeping, unaware of what was happening upstairs. The two girls were sharing a bed for the night, and the killer swung the axe and ended 8-year-old Ina's life, then attacked 12-year-old Lena. Evidence suggests that Lena may have been the only one who awoke and actually tried to fight back. She was found lying crosswise on the bed with a defensive wound on her arm. Investigators believed Lena was awake at some point during the attack. Her nightgown was pushed up, and a blood stain on her knee indicated that she may have moved or kicked her legs. Lena's body was found partially hanging off the bed. Her underwear was missing, and her nightshirt was pulled up, leading some to suspect that there was a sexual motive or an assault that took place. Now, there was no definitive evidence of sexual abuse that was found that night. However, this is 1912, and so obviously there capabilities of testing for that kind of thing were far behind. The poor girl likely awoke to find a nightmare and only had seconds to react. In the end, all 8 victims had been savagely murdered with an axe, their skulls crushed as they slept. This was a crime of extraordinary brutality, made even more horrifying by the age of the victims and the apparent silence with which it was carried out. As shocking as the murders were, the scene the killer left was beyond bizarre. Sometime before dawn, the murderer took time to stage the house in a really peculiar way. He went through each room and covered the glass. Every mirror in the house was draped with cloth or bedding, and even the windows had been covered, curtains drawn, and where there were no curtains, clothing hung over the glass. The faces of the Moore parents and the children were also covered with blankets or cloth where they lay. It was as if the killer couldn't bear to look at his victims or his own reflection, maybe suggesting a mixture of guilt or shame, maybe ritual or superstition. Next, the killer found a kerosene oil lamp in the house. He removed the lamp's glass chimney and placed it aside, leaving the wick burning but turned down low. And this would have cast just a faint, eerie glow within the house, enough for the killer to navigate the rooms without waking anybody or drawing attention from anyone outside. The lamp with its chimney off was later found at the top of the stairs. Nearby, the murderer dropped a peculiar clue, a fragment of a keychain, as police later noted, did not belong to any member of the Moore family. Now, perhaps the most infamous oddity was discovered in the kitchen. On a table, there was a piece of uneaten food, and some reports say that it was a plate of untouched bacon and beans and a basin of bloody water, as if the killer had washed his hands. The bacon was wrapped in a dish towel, leaning against the wall near the axe. Now, why on earth would a killer take out a slab of bacon and place it like that? This detail has confounded everyone for over a century. Some speculate that it might have been intended as a bizarre ritual or even an attempt at some kind of sexual fetish object, while others think that the murderer had planned to eat but then abandoned the idea. we'll likely never know the true reason, but its presence is this weird, morbid detail, a calling card of the Villisca killer. After covering mirrors, dimming the lamp, and leaving those strange items, the murderer picked up the axe one last time and leaned it against the wall in the downstairs bedroom where the Stillinger sisters were. He then quietly exited the house, locking the doors behind him with a key, and based on later estimates, the killer likely slipped away in the pre-dawn darkness sometime between 4 and 5 a.m., just before the sun came up. By the time the sun crept over the horizon on June 10th, the little white house at 508 East 2nd Street was deadly silent. The crime had been carried out with such an eerie calm that no one in the neighborhood heard a single disturbance during the night. Early Monday morning, around 5 a.m., neighbor Mary Peckham stepped into her yard to hang laundry and begin her daily chores. Mary noticed that the Moore house next door seemed unusually still. The Moore family were early risers. The kids should have been up and getting ready for school, or the chores should have been done and or at least underway by now. But by 7 a.m., Mary grew concerned. The house remained quiet, shades drawn, and even the Moore chickens were still cooped up and unfed. So Mary knocked on the Moore's door hard, but nobody answered. She tried to peer in through the windows, but all the curtains were tightly closed. Finding the front door unlocked, Mary became worried that the family might be ill or worse. So she let the Moore's chickens out to at least take care of something and then called Joe's brother, Ross Moore, hoping that he might have a house key or maybe an explanation. Ross Moore arrived sometime after 8 a.m., growing anxious himself because he hadn't seen his brother's family yet that day. Using his copy of the house key, Ross unlocked the front door, and Mary Peckham stood nervously on the front porch while Ross stepped inside the silent house, calling out, "Joe? Sarah?" But there was no response, only this unsettling, heavy quiet. Ross first opened a door to the downstairs guest bedroom, and what he saw there would haunt him forever. In the dim room, he could make out two figures on the bed, bodies covered with a sheet. As his eyes adjusted, he saw that a small arm was hanging out from under the bedding, limp and lifeless. Ross recoiled in shock and ran back to the front porch, his face drained of all its color. So Mary Peckham hurried back to her house to place an emergency call to Marshal Hank Horton. Horton arrived quickly, as did Dr. Cooper, the local physician. Ross's terrible discovery was confirmed when Horton entered the house with Ross, and the figures in the guest bedroom were, of course, the bodies of Lena and Ina Stillinger, the young sisters who had literally just been spending the night. Marshal Horton and Ross cautiously proceeded through the house, and room by room, their worst fears were realized. The entire Moore family, Josiah, Sarah, and their four children, were found dead, still in their beds, all brutally murdered with the blows of an axe. There were 8 victims in total, and the scene was nightmare-worthy, even for any hardened professional or sheriff or marshal. Horton later recounted that in the upstairs bedrooms, blood splatters covered the walls and ceilings. The victims' heads had been smashed beyond recognition. He found the murder weapon, Josiah's own axe, abandoned in the downstairs bedroom near the sisters. It was immediately obvious that this was a massacre unlike anything that the small town of Villisca had ever seen. Shaken to his core but doing his duty, Marshal Horton secured the gruesome scene as best as he could and summoned additional help from law enforcement. By 8:30 a.m., news of the tragedy began to spread through Villisca. The telephone operator at the town's central switchboard was instructed to send out an emergency all call to Villisca residents, alerting everyone that something terrible had happened at the Moore house. In 1912, this kind of automated phone tree was the fastest way to broadcast urgent news. And within moments of the announcement, a crowd started gathering on the Moore property. First, neighbors and curious townsfolk, then people from the surrounding countryside and nearby towns, all drawn by shock and morbid curiosity. People wanted answers, and they gravitated to the Moore home hoping to glean any new information. Unfortunately, 1912 was long before modern crime scene management, and what happened next severely undermined the investigation. As crowds converged on the Moore residence that morning, the scene descended into chaos. The local authorities were utterly unprepared to control hundreds of onlookers. Villisca's Sheriff Orrin Jackson was out of town that day, leaving Marshal Horton as the primary officer on site. Try as he might, Horton could not keep the curious hordes from tromping through the house. Onlookers, possibly 100 or more people, walked through this blood-spattered house, walking through the bedrooms, peeking at the victims as if it was this morbid museum that wasn't an active crime scene. Incredibly, some gawkers even picked up and handled the murder weapon, passing around Joe's axe as this sick sort of souvenir before law enforcement finally intervened. Even more grotesque, at least one townsperson snipped a fragment of Josiah Moore's skull to keep as a keepsake. In short, the crime scene was trampled and contaminated by scores of people within just a couple hours of the discovery. Crucial evidence was likely destroyed or tainted at that point, and it was a detective's worst nightmare. I can't even imagine that. I mean, 1912 was just such a different time, obviously. It's crazy to think that that wasn't really that long ago, and that people would do that kind of thing, just walk through a house without any regard of the weight of what happened in that house. Around 9 a.m., the county coroner, Dr. F.S. Lindquist, arrived at the Moore house. He was completely disgusted at the carnival-like atmosphere and immediately urged officials to secure the scene. Luckily, Villisca had a National Guard armory in town, so help was nearby. By 10:30 a.m., the National Guard arrived to push back the crowd and establish a perimeter around the home. At last, more than 3 hours after the bodies were found, the crime scene was officially quarantined, but the damage had been done. Whatever trace evidence the killer left was likely compromised. No fingerprints, footprints, or useful forensic clues could be reliably collected after so many people had swarmed through. It's really maddening to think how differently this might have gone if this scene had been preserved, but that was the reality of policing in a small town in 1912. Once the house was finally cleared of civilians, Dr. Lindquist and Marshall Horton conducted a thorough examination of the scene. All the victims were examined before they were moved, and the physician and coroner concluded that the murders had occurred in the very early morning hours, roughly between midnight and 5 a.m. The victim's skull wounds confirmed the blunt force trauma from an axe as the cause of their death. Blood spatter analysis, basic as it was at the time, and other clues indicated that the killer attacked them with the axe while they were sleeping. In fact, newspapers marveled at how a killer could move room to room in this creaky old house and not awake a single person who was asleep in the house. Some speculated that perhaps the killer had administered some sort of sedative or drug to the family to keep them asleep. However, this was pure conjecture. Toxicology tests were not done. They weren't even routine in autopsies back then. But the more likely explanation is simply that the murders were quick and silent. There were no guns fired, nobody screamed, and the victims were deep in their sleep in the darkness. Investigators did notice some interesting evidence while combing through the property. Out in the barn behind the house, they found a depression in the hay and a knot hole in the wall that looked out toward the house. The theory arose that the killer might have spent part of the evening in that barn, peering through that knot hole to watch the Moore family's movements, waiting for the right moment to strike. If so, it paints an image of a predator who stalked his victims and knew the family's routine. Inside the house, they found items like the oil lamp with the chimney removed from it and the piece of a keychain that didn't belong, suggesting that the intruder came prepared and left behind small traces of himself. Now, we've already talked about the bizarre bacon and the bloody wash basin, which were duly noted as evidence as well, and the axe, of course, was recovered and identified as coming from the Moore's own woodshed. Dr. Lindquist convened a coroner's inquest the very next day on June 11th of 1912. A coroner's jury, which is a panel of local men, was assembled to hear testimony and try to determine just what the basic facts were. Essentially, this is like an early step to decide if there was enough evidence to charge someone, if anyone. And over a dozen people were interviewed, including Mary Peckham and Ross Moore, and others who might shed light on any kind of suspicious people in town. The testimony established the timeline, the family's activities that night, the discovery of their bodies, etc., but did not yet single out a prime suspect. And how could it, when there were no obvious culprit and there were so many people that trampled through the house, how can you possibly single out a single person? The inquest conclusion was simply that the 8 victims came to their deaths at the hands of a person or persons unknown, and it was officially ruled a mass homicide, and that was it. In the days and weeks immediately following the murders, law enforcement and volunteers ran down hundreds of leads. With a crime scene this heinous, everyone was a potential suspect. Every transient traveler or stranger who had passed through Villisca recently was questioned. The town was in a state of panic. Families started locking their doors at night, many for the first time ever, and guarding their children closely. Posses of armed men would patrol at night, and anxious rumors flew at every turn. Initially, there were local rumors that maybe someone in the family or a close acquaintance had gone berserk. One early suspect was Joe Moore's own brother-in-law, Sam Moyer, because apparently Sam had once threatened to kill Josiah during some argument. But upon investigation, Sam Moyer had a clear alibi and was quickly ruled out. It just didn't fit. The sheer savagery of the crime led many to believe that it was the work of a madman or an axe maniac who wandered into town rather than someone with a personal grudge. Within the first week, police arrested a transient man found sleeping in a barn near Villisca just because he couldn't give a good account of his whereabouts from that night. This man was Andy Sawyer, who was a vagrant who turned out to be obsessed with the case and oddly slept with an axe by his side. But ultimately, Sawyer had no connection to Villisca and no evidence on him. He was just one of many drifters that was investigated and cleared. The lack of an obvious suspect left the community very frustrated and fearful, I'm sure you can imagine. And the Iowa State authorities eventually got involved, and neighboring law enforcement agencies pitched in as well. Detective Matthew McCleary of the Burns Detective Agency, which was a well-known private detective firm of that era, was hired to assist the investigation. And later, a private detective named James Newton Wilkerson also took a key interest in the case.
Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is ZBiotics. You've heard me talk before about their pre-alcohol probiotic drink, and today I've got something new and exciting to share because their amazing team just dropped another product, and it's designed to effortlessly boost your fiber intake without making you overhaul your entire diet. So listen, only 5% of Americans get enough fiber. And if you're anything like me, it's probably because remembering to eat high fiber foods consistently feels kind of tough sometimes. So that is why I started adding the ZBiotic Sugar to Fiber probiotic drink mix to my daily routine. Now here's what's cool about it. The brilliant microbiologists at ZBiotics created Sugar to Fiber to transform sugar from the food you're already eating into this special prebiotic fiber called Levan. Now honestly, I had never even heard of Levan before any of this, but it turns out that it's super beneficial and usually pretty tough to get from everyday foods. It helps increase both the amount and variety of fiber your body receives, which is awesome for your gut. So I genuinely love this product because it doesn't require me to change anything else about my day. Every morning, I just toss a pack of Sugar to Fiber into my smoothie or my water bottle, and that is it. And it feels so good knowing something I'm already consuming is being put to better use by my body. Now, you all know that gut health is super important, and that's why I'm sticking with ZBiotic Sugar to Fiber throughout this summer. It's an easy little habit that makes a big difference for my overall wellness. So if you want to give it a shot, head over to zbiotics.com/mama and enter the code MAMA, which is M-A-M-A, at checkout for 15% off your first order. Plus, ZBiotics is totally risk-free. They offer a 100% money-back guarantee, so if it doesn't work out, they will refund your money with zero hassle. Again, big thanks to ZBiotics for sponsoring today's episode. And now we're going to get back to the case of the Villisca, Iowa axe murders.
As the summer of 1912 wore on, a few promising theories began to crystallize around certain suspects. But this case was about to get very complicated, with accusations flying in all directions. So let's walk through the most notable suspects and the theories that emerged in the Villisca axe murders investigation. Perhaps the most bizarre suspect was Reverend George Kelly, an English-born traveling minister and a truly eccentric character. Reverend Kelly was in Villisca on the very night of the murders, having attended the same Children's Day church program that the Moore family and those Stillinger sisters participated in. The thing is, Reverend Kelly was tiny. He was 5'2". He was this preacher with a history of mental problems and erratic behavior. He had suffered a mental breakdown in his youth. And as an adult, he was known for odd, inappropriate conduct. Like, he had reportedly had this habit of asking young women and girls to pose nude for him. Not exactly normal clergy behavior, and had been caught peeping through windows. Now, in the days leading up to June 10th, Kelly had been staying in towns around the area and came to Villisca to guest preach at the Children's Day service. He left town in the early morning hours sometime between 5 and 5:30 a.m. on June 10th, supposedly taking an outbound train just before the bodies were discovered. This timing alone was enough to raise eyebrows. After the murders, Reverend Kelly displayed a suspicious fascination with the case. He wrote many letters to police, investigators, and even the victims' families, pestering them about details of the crime. He would talk about the Villisca murders constantly, seeming to know a lot of the gory particulars. In one letter to a detective, Kelly claimed to have heard sounds on the night of the murder and even to have witnessed the killings from afar. Now, this was extremely odd. Why would he, of all people, have been creeping around at 2 a.m. near the Moore house? His obsessive correspondence and erratic assertions made him a person of interest pretty quick. Authorities wondered, did Kelly know so much because he did it, or was he just imaginatively unhinged? Given his mental instability, it was really hard to tell. 2 years later, in 1914, Reverend Kelly was actually arrested in another incident. He was caught sending obscene, sexually harassing material through the mail to a woman who had applied to be his secretary. He was sent to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which is a mental institution in Washington, D.C., for evaluation. By 1917, the Villisca murder investigation had stagnated, and pressure was on the authorities to solve the case. Perhaps desperate for a break, investigators circled back to George Kelly, who by then had moved around the Midwest. That year, Kelly was arrested and charged with the Villisca murders. During a long interrogation, Kelly, who was known to be easily suggestible, confessed to the axe murders after hours of questioning. However, he almost immediately recanted his confession. And it's important to note that false confessions are not uncommon in high-profile cases, especially from individuals with mental illnesses or those who are subjected to intense pressure. Nonetheless, Kelly went to trial for the murders, and the first trial ended with a hung jury because the jurors couldn't reach a unanimous verdict. A second trial was held in November of 1917, and this time the jury acquitted Reverend Kelly, finding him not guilty due to lack of concrete evidence. There was simply no physical evidence tying him to the crime. So after his acquittal, Kelly faded from the public eye. He spent time in mental hospitals off and on, and he died decades later, never having faced justice for anything related to Villisca. To this day, some feel that Kelly's confession, even if it was coerced, had details that only the killer would know, and thus they suspect that he was the real axe murderer. Others believe that he was just a disturbed man who wanted attention and infamy, falsely confessing to a horrible crime that he didn't actually commit. And now the truth remains uncertain, possibly somewhere in between, but officially, Reverend George Kelly was the only person who was ever actually tried in this case, and he was acquitted. Now, from eerie preacher to prominent politician, our next suspect is a very different type of person. Frank Fernando Jones was an Iowa state senator and one of Villisca's most powerful figures. He was also someone who had a well-known feud with Josiah Moore. As we discussed earlier, Josiah had worked as the top salesman at Frank Jones's farm equipment dealership for years. In 1907, Josiah left Frank's company and started his own competing business. So the departure wasn't amicable. When Josiah left, he managed to take a major client, which was the lucrative John Deere franchise. And that effectively became Jones's business rival across the street. So this bad blood only worsened with time, I'm sure you can imagine. On top of that, local gossip hinted at an even more scandalous rift that Josiah was rumored to have carried on an affair with Frank's daughter-in-law, Donna, the wife of Jones's son, Albert. Now, there was no proof of this alleged affair, but small-town rumor mills can be vicious. True or not, it's easy to imagine how such talk could make Frank Jones despise Josiah Moore. In short, Senator Jones had motives, financial and possibly personal as well, to wish harm upon Joe Moore. But would a well-respected 57-year-old politician really hire someone to wipe out an entire family, including children, over a business grudge? It sounds pretty extreme. Nevertheless, many in Villisca and beyond whispered that Frank Jones must have been involved. So this became known as the political revenge theory. Jones was in his 50s and certainly not suspected of wielding the axe himself, but the theory went that he hired a killer, or a hitman essentially, to get rid of Joe Moore and his family. In fact, some of the early newspaper accusations pointed a finger at Jones, much to his outrage. He vehemently denied any involvement. However, the prominent Burns Detective Agency, which got involved in the case around 1915, took this theory pretty seriously. Detective James, or Jim Wilkerson, a private investigator with Burns, openly accused Frank Jones of engineering the murders. Wilkerson believed that Jones employed a known killer, and we'll get to him next, to do the deed, and that Jones used his influence to cover up evidence and throw the investigation off its track. Frank Jones, being a powerful man, fought back against these allegations, and the feud between Detective Wilkerson and Senator Jones got very nasty and very public. Wilkerson would hold public meetings in which he would essentially prosecute Jones in the court of public opinion, laying out these supposed pieces of evidence of Jones's guilt, while Jones used his political connections to discredit Wilkerson. At one point, Jones even convened a grand jury to investigate Wilkerson for slander. So this rivalry between these two became almost its own sideshow to the Villisca case. In the end, no hard evidence ever tied Frank Jones to the crime. He was never charged. Many Villisca residents believed in his innocence. Why would an upright citizen do something so horrific? But others were convinced that the murders were a calculated hit job at his demand. Now, the truth, we can't be sure. Frank Jones lived out the rest of his life with this dark cloud of suspicion hanging over him in some circles, but legally he faced no consequences. He died in 1941, having always maintained his innocence. The Jones theory remains one of the most debated because it speaks to a motive of vengeance and an attempt to eliminate an enemy, but it requires believing that this respected public figure would massacre children to achieve that goal. So that's a tough pill to swallow, yet the circumstantial motives and the intensity of Jones's feud with Joe really kept that theory alive for a lot of people. Now, if Frank Jones indeed hired someone to carry out the murders, many suspected that that someone was William Mansfield. William, who went by Billy, often nicknamed Blackie, was a suspected serial murderer and known criminal drifter. Billy Mansfield had served in the U.S. Army and had been stationed at Fort Leavenworth at some point, but by 1912, he was a transient manual laborer with a violent reputation. Now, here's why Mansfield is often linked to Villisca. Detective James Wilkerson, the one accusing Frank Jones, built a case that Mansfield was a serial axe killer responsible for a string of family murders across the Midwest, including the Villisca murders. Wilkerson believed that Senator Jones hired Mansfield to kill the Moore family, promising him a hefty reward. Mansfield, in this theory, was basically a contract killer who also happened to just enjoy murdering people with axes. It sounds far-fetched, but let's examine the details. So there were indeed several earlier eerily similar axe murder cases around the time of the Villisca axe murders. For instance, just 9 months before Villisca in September of 1911, a family in Colorado Springs, Colorado, was murdered in their beds with an axe. Then, not long after, two more families were slaughtered in axe attacks in small towns in Kansas, one being Ellsworth, Kansas, and another in Payola. The Villisca case in 1912 bore striking similarities to those crimes. In several of those cases, the killer or killers covered the mirrors and the windows in the houses, just as was done in Villisca. Bed sheets or clothing were used to cover windows in Colorado Springs, for example, just like the aprons and dresses hung over the windows in the Moore house. In multiple scenes, the murderer left a lamp burning with the chimney off, and a basin of water was found where the killer washed up. All were MO details matching the Villisca murders. It's hard not to see the pattern here. Families bludgeoned with an axe in their sleep, mirrors and windows are covered, there's a lamp left burning, axes left at the scene, no fingerprints. So yeah, it seems like these are all done by the same person. Detective Wilkerson was convinced that William Blackie Mansfield fit the bill as this traveling axe murderer. Mansfield had a criminal record and was rumored to be addicted to cocaine, hence the nickname Insane Blackie. I actually feel like that might be super offensive, but I don't know. Shockingly, 2 years after Villisca in 1914, Mansfield was the prime suspect in the axe murders of his own wife, infant child, father-in-law, and mother-in-law in Blue Island, Illinois. Yes, you heard that right. Mansfield was accused of butchering his own family with an axe. Additionally, Wilkerson linked Mansfield to the axe murder of a woman and her daughter in Aurora, Illinois, as well as the murders in Payola, Kansas, which were just days before Villisca. Now, in each case, the similarities in method are chilling. Wilkerson was so confident that Mansfield was the Villisca killer that he tracked the man for years. He claimed that he could place Mansfield in every town where these murders occurred on the exact dates. One key point, all these crimes occurred near train lines, and Mansfield was known to work as a railroad worker or frequently traveled by train. Villisca itself was a railroad town, and the Morehouse was only a few blocks from the depot. One of the strongest pieces of circumstantial evidence Wilkerson touted was Mansfield's knowledge of avoiding fingerprints. Back in 1912, fingerprinting was a relatively new technique, and it was true that no usable fingerprints were found on the murder scene, despite the killer handling the axe and the lamp. Wilkerson argued that Mansfield, who had been imprisoned before, knew his fingerprints were on file at Leavenworth Prison, so he wore gloves during his crimes. Indeed, at Villisca, no bloody fingerprints were found, which could either mean that the killer wore gloves or simply that prints smudged and it wasn't properly checked. Still, the idea that the killer carefully wiped down the axe and surfaces or used gloves fed into the notion of a shrewd, possibly experienced murderer. Mansfield was actually arrested and brought to Iowa to face this inquiry, and it seemed like the case might finally crack open. But in a dramatic turn, Mansfield produced payroll records and eyewitnesses that showed he was working in Illinois at the time of the Villisca murders. The alibi was solid enough that the grand jury decided not to indict him. Mansfield was released, and he promptly filed a lawsuit against Detective Wilkerson for wrongful arrest and defamation. In 1917, Mansfield won that suit and was awarded $2,225 in damages, which would be worth about $73,000 today. Now, this was a huge blow to Wilkerson's theory. Mansfield essentially got the last laughs. Yet, even with his alibi, some questions still linger, and a witness named Mrs. Vina Tompkins claimed that she overheard three men in the woods plotting to kill the Moore family shortly before the crime, hinting at some sort of conspiracy. These leads never fully panned out, however, and officially Mansfield was never charged with anything related to Villisca. Many historians think that Mansfield was indeed a serial killer, possibly responsible for dozens of axe murders. But whether he was in Villisca that night remains unproven. If he was, did Frank Jones hire him, or was it just part of Mansfield's own murder spree? Now, another potential serial killer suspect emerged in the form of Henry Lee Moore, and it's important to note that he was not related to the Moore family whatsoever, but Henry Lee Moore was a 35-year-old man who, like Mansfield, had a penchant for killing with an axe. In fact, in the months after the Villisca murders, Henry Moore was convicted of murdering his own mother and grandmother with an axe in Columbia, Missouri. These murders occurred in late 1912, not long after the Villisca murders. And because of the method and timing, some investigators at the time wondered if Henry Moore might have been responsible for the Villisca crime and others. A federal officer, Department of Justice agent Matthew McClaffrey, actually hypothesized that Henry Moore was a serial axe killer who could have committed the Villisca murders as part of a killing spree. Henry Moore had been a suspect in several Midwest axe slayings before he was finally caught for killing his relatives. All told, the pattern of his crimes looked very familiar. Family groups bludgeoned with an axe while they were sleeping, just like what happened in Villisca. However, aside from the modus operandi, there was not any specific evidence tying Henry Moore to Villisca. Once he was convicted for the Columbia, Missouri murders, the focus on him as the Villisca culprit really waned, and law enforcement seemed content that he was off the streets serving a life sentence, perhaps believing he might indeed have done some of those crimes, but nothing concrete ever linked him to Villisca. Still, in the catalog of suspects, Henry Moore is often listed as a possibility, especially for those who favor the roving serial killer theory explanation over the local revenge theories. Henry Moore and William Mansfield collectively give weight to the idea that an unknown psychopath, rather than someone with a personal vendetta, could have been behind not just Villisca, but multiple similar atrocities. Now, the four men that I mentioned, Reverend Kelly, Frank Jones, William Mansfield, and Henry Moore, tend to dominate the discussions when it comes to the Villisca suspects. But they were not the only ones. We've already mentioned Andy Sawyer, the transient who was briefly suspected and cleared. Investigators also looked at troubled individuals, other possible drifters, and even a detective's wild theory about a multi-person conspiracy. For instance, at one point, a local father and son, whose names are often mentioned, are the Burnsides or the Souders, depending on the source that you're pulling from, but they were actually accused by a state detective of helping Mansfield commit the murders as accomplices, but this was never substantiated. One modern theory worth noting is that of the man on the train. In 2017, crime writer Bill James and his daughter Rachel published a book called The Man from the Train. In it, they proposed that a single prolific serial killer was responsible for dozens of axe murders across the United States in the early 20th century, including the Villisca murders. They dug through historical records and found an array of family massacres that had striking similarities. Their suspect is an elusive German immigrant named Paul Mueller, or Miller, who was the subject of a manhunt for an axe murder of a family in Massachusetts in 97. The Jameses believe this same man hopped freight trains and carried out a series of killings over the next decade or more, targeting families in small towns near railroad lines. The common features they identified in these crimes are stunningly specific and match Villisca. The families lived near train tracks, murders happened close to midnight, the killer used the blunt side of an axe found at the house, he covered the victims with blankets, covered the windows and mirrors, left a lamp burning low without its chimney, and locked the house up as he left. Those details read like a checklist of what we see at the Moore House. Years later, in 1931, Iowa's attorney general officially closed the Villisca case, announcing that all leads had been exhausted and no further action would be taken. By then, nearly two decades had passed, and many key figures were either dead or very old, and essentially the state admitted defeat. The Villisca Axe Murders case was never officially solved, and no one was ever punished for the crime. Looking back with modern eyes, it's easy to spot the many missed opportunities and investigative failures in this case. First and foremost, the crime scene being compromised would be number one, as a huge blunder, allowing dozens of townspeople to wander through and even take souvenirs, all but destroyed whatever forensic evidence might have existed. And if this happened today, it would be an absolute investigative disaster and a media circus. Key evidence like fingerprints, hair, or blood drops from the killer likely vanished or were never recorded. We know that the killer left a perfectly good fingerprint surface like the axe handle or even the lamp, but any fingerprints on it were either smeared or wiped clean, possibly either by the killer and certainly by the gawkers who handled it afterwards. Proper fingerprint dusting might have yielded something, given that by 1912, fingerprint analysis was known, though not routine. But after that crowd, there was obviously no hope. Likewise, the cigarette butts reportedly found in the attic might have contained the killer's saliva, but DNA testing was science fiction back then, of course. I don't think it even became a thing until the mid-80s. But even basic chemical analysis or tracing the tobacco might have given some clues. However, sadly, the cigarette's existence is even disputed. Some say that that was just a rumor, so nothing solid ever came from that evidence. On June 13th of 1912, a massive funeral was held for the Moore family and the Stillinger sisters. Villisca was too small to handle the crowd, so the service was moved to the town square park, where an estimated 5,000 to 7,000 people attended to pay their respects. Thousands of mourners lined the streets as the procession of horse-drawn hearses carried the eight coffins to their burial site. It was likely the largest gathering Villisca had ever seen, a testament to how the tragedy had touched so many people. The story made headlines nationwide, often labeled as the worst crime in Iowa's history, a title it arguably still holds. In the years that followed, the case became a cautionary tale. The idea that an entire family could be slaughtered in their home at night left an entire generation of Midwesterners anxious about bedtime security. It wasn't uncommon for families around Iowa to start double-checking their door locks and even sleeping with weapons nearby. It was a cultural shift in a time when folks usually felt safe in small towns. As decades passed, the story of Villisca drifted into local legend. The Moore House itself changed hands several times. For a long while, it was just another private residence. Families actually lived there. Yes, in the very house where the murders occurred. Throughout the 1920s, 30s, and beyond. I cannot imagine living in a house where something so horrific had happened. I would think that people would burn it down. But unsurprisingly, whispers of ghostly activity began almost immediately. Neighbors and later occupants reported strange noises, voices, and an eerie feeling of being watched in the house. In 1994, a local couple, Darwin and Martha Lynn, purchased the rundown property, and they had a vision to both restore the house to its 1912 condition and open it up to the public as a historic and by then paranormal attraction. The house was carefully renovated, removing modernizations and refurnishing it with period-appropriate items to resemble how it looked in the Moore's time. Once restored, it officially became known as the Villisca Axe Murder House, and it's now one of the most infamous haunted houses in the United States. By day, guided tours take visitors through the small white house, explaining the history and pointing out the exact spots where each victim was found. By night, the truly brave, or perhaps crazy, can book an overnight stay in the house. And many people do, particularly ghost hunters and true crime enthusiasts. And it has been featured on numerous paranormal TV shows, like Discovery Channel's Ghost Adventures did an episode there, for example. And visitors and investigators have claimed all sorts of spooky encounters. Children's laughter when no children are present, lamps falling over, mysterious chills, and even the faint impressions of bloody footprints that appear on the wooden floors. Now, this is crazy, but in 2014, there was someone who was spending the night at the house, and in the middle of the night at around 2 a.m., he inexplicably stabbed himself, and he stabbed himself at around the same time that the murders were believed to have taken place. In the end, the Villisca Axe Murders leaves us with more questions than answers. It's a story of a happy family and two sweet visiting girls whose lives were cut short in the most violent and atrocious way, in a place where they should have been safe. Over a century later, their case stands as one of true crime's most haunting narratives. At the end of the day, when I hear cases like this, especially ones that happened so long ago and yet kind of within our generation, like my grandparents were alive at that time, and so it's really not that far removed from where we are now. It's crazy to think about how far we've come when it comes to forensic technology or just technology in general. And it's wild to think just about how modern we are now and how times were different then. There wasn't just a TV where you could turn it on and get the latest information, or a phone or a computer. Like, none of those things existed. And it's kind of crazy to think that people who are still alive today existed in a time like that. I know this probably sounds kind of like a stone thought or like an obvious thought, but it really is just kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. And Austin and I talk often about the theory of Sonder, like just imagining what it's like to live in someone else's shoes and what their day-to-day life is like, whether it's here, somewhere else, or in a different time. And so when I think about living in 1912, I can't imagine how terrifying that would be. I feel like it's a common thought that today people are more vicious than they were back then. But I think stories like this point to the fact that evil exists in every century, in every generation. And maybe now we're just more aware of it because of social media and technology. However, I do find relief in the fact that we have technology to actually catch these people. To think that this guy, whoever did this, just lived out the rest of his life getting away with such a horrific crime is really scary to think about. But I think we can be relieved that that's a lot less likely to happen nowadays. So with that said, thank you so much for listening to Mama Mystery. I appreciate you listening and sharing these episodes and leaving reviews or comments. I appreciate you so much. So have a great week. We'll catch you for the weekly docket on Thursday or Friday. That's it. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.